Okay, so what have we been talking about? We've been talking about preaching Christ, preaching the gospel from the Old Testament. That's the theme of the week, if you didn't know, for me. And we started off by saying, what's the problem? And the problem basically is that we are having a lot of people promote the idea that anytime you preach from the Old Testament, or for that matter, the New Testament, that you should preach always what the terminology is Christocentrically, centered around Jesus. Some people use the word Christotelic, that is aimed toward Jesus, consummating in Jesus, or the gospel. And they sometimes will mix those two things together, okay? And what I suggested to you is that there is too narrow a notion of what it means to be Christocentric and too narrow a notion of what it means to be gospel preaching. That instead of isolating just a very thin thread of what we think that might mean, we need to look more carefully and try to derive what it might be to be Christocentric as preachers by looking more broadly at that topic and also for the gospel. So the first thing we did yesterday then was to talk about the gospel side of this. And remember, the basic issue here is that there's been a long history of using the Bible, not just Old, but New Testament also, atomistically. That is, using it as a sort of database for theological issues, whatever they may be. And you can see that in traditional systematic theologies, traditional confessions and things, that the Bible is more or less this database of information or data, propositions, that then you bring into your theology. So you get to a passage and you notice it talks something about God, and so that's what you preach about. Or you talk about this, and you preach about that, and you talk about this, preach about that. And the people who have seen this have noticed something, at least they think they've noticed something, and that is that the result of that, not just in people's lives, but in the tradition of the church, has been that the priorities of our Christian theology are not aligned with the priorities of the Bible. Imagine such a thing as that. So in other words, if you treat the Bible, do I need to repeat this? You treat the Bible, because you're looking at me like, what? I think he just said something important. I wasn't following until that moment, and I didn't get the important thing either, so let me repeat it. If you treat the Bible like it's a database, and you start drawing things out of it, more or less at random, but not exactly at random, but more or less, not providing too much concern with the big picture of the Bible, that sort of thing, then the natural tendency, of course, is for you to be guided by something other than the Bible and the way you arrange and prioritize that data. Now, you got that? And in the Christian tradition, in the Christian church, those two other things that have organized and prioritized our theological beliefs, believe it or not, have not been the Bible. They have been, first, Neoplatonism, second, Aristotelianism, and third, modern science. Ooh, that sounds bad, doesn't it? It is bad. And so people began to notice then that the theology that we cherish from this atomistic database kind of approach ends up being not anti-Bible, but just not matching up with the Bible in its priorities, its methods, the things it emphasizes and stresses. And that's why you have grown, if you've been a become a Christian in the last 10 years and you've been studying theology and Bible and things like that, in all likelihood, if you're like most people in the UK now, you have not spent a lot of time in traditional systematic theology. Say yes. Fine. See, I told you. Now, the reason for this is because you've been led and you have lived in a Christian community, especially in the UK, that has pushed against that approach to the Bible because of what they saw as the negatives. Okay? And so they want to make the Bible its priorities, its methods, this is the movement called biblical theology, make its issues the prominent issues in Christian theology too. And that's where a lot of this Christological emphasis comes from, because biblical theology sees Jesus as the culmination of it all. So if you're going to treat the Bible in any way in a sermon, don't treat it like a database for abstract theological propositions. Treat it as something that leads you to Jesus. Bring it into a system of developmental system that leads and culminates in Jesus. Well, who would object to that? Anybody want to say, no, we shouldn't do that kind of thing? Of course not, okay? Only problem is when you think that by doing that, you somehow have gotten closer to the Bible. That's the problem. But that's a good thing to do, so no problem. The same thing with the gospel. The gospel is primarily rising out of the fact that for a long time now, in both your country and mine and others like ours, there has been an increasing concern over hypocrisy and legalism in otherwise very good churches. You know, we all know that the enemies over there, the liberals, we know they don't believe anything, okay? So we can, like, go like this to them and things like that and tell them to stay away. But the problem here is in-house. When you have people who profess Christ and give credible professions of faith, as a matter of fact, but as they study the Bible and as they study the Christian faith and theology, they gradually become what we would tend to call Pharisaical. And you know what that means. It means they have pride and attitudes toward other Christians. They are very much oriented toward moral obligation. First it's data, but then it's moral obligation. So they really want to sit down with you and discuss whether or not you should get a newspaper on Sunday morning. I mean, they literally think that's a reasonable conversation to have. Is that you? Okay, or... you know, those kinds of things. So, well, what's the answer to that? The answer to that is to emphasize the gospel according to people in our circles. If you are a Pharisee, then what you want to do is repent of that, become a recovering Pharisee, and the way you do that is by preaching the gospel to yourself every day. Well, that's fine and good, so long as the gospel is seen as an antidote to legalism. That means the gospel for you is going to be the contra of legalism. Yes or no? Okay. So it's all about grace. It's all about faith. And there's very little attention or priority given to what is clearly a priority, not just in the old, but in the new as well. And that is moral obligation. The Westminster Shorter Catechism, as you know well, I'm sure, not. Ask, what do the scriptures principally teach? And the answer is, the scriptures principally teach what we are to believe concerning God and what duty God requires of man. Okay, so doctrine and duty. Well, duty is a bad word nowadays. Shouldn't be, but it is in many circles. So I talked about that good news idea yesterday, okay, and the contrast that's set up between Old and New Testament. Do you remember that? Okay, does this sound familiar at all? I'm trying to say it in a little bit different ways, but it should sound sort of, oh, well, that's what he was talking about. Yeah, the idea then is that if you have this idea, belief that the good news of Jesus is a declaration that you're saved by grace through faith, and that is pretty much the whole package, then what you're going to do is you're going to find some things in the Old Testament that correlate with that, because obviously New Testament writers got that message from the Old Testament. Now, some people, dispensationalists, don't believe that, but we do. We should. We know it's there, but it's a thin thread compared to the thick thread of the Old Testament, which is moral obligation. And so that part, you go toward it, but you back away from it, because the only reason the rules are there, our primary reason the rules are there, is to show you what a sinner you are, so you'll rely on grace more and your faith in Jesus more. Nice, huh? Okay, I suggested that's too narrow an idea of what the gospel is. That instead, the word good news in the New Testament, euangelion, is rooted in an Old Testament concept of delivering good news. And who can tell me the general broad definition of what good news is in the Old Testament, and not, by the way, just the Old Testament, but also other cultures around Israel used a similar expression. What did they describe as good news? They're announcing good news. They got good news. What was it? Victory in battle. That's right. Especially when they're talking about kings and kingdoms and things like that. You can have good news when you have a baby. That's good news also. But when you're having a king and a kingdom, it's a warfare. I mean, you've won the battle, so there it is. And that really is, in my opinion, the genuine background of New Testament gospel. It's a war theme. Victory in war. And there are two sides to victory always. Can you tell me what those two are? That's right. You know, if you mumble, I'll say, I heard it, and I'll give you the right answer. What are the two sides of victory of God's kingdom?
Salvation and judgment.
Always both. Yes? The disempowerment and elimination, punishment and elimination of the enemies of God. That's the judgment. Did you hear the way I put that? Disempowerment. What's the second thing I said? Destruction and elimination. Does that make sense? Eliminated from where? Do we believe they are annihilated? Say no. Say no. You haven't fallen into that, have they, Willie? No, good. Because it's coming from your country too to mine. What do I mean when I say eliminated? Eliminated from where? Ultimately. Yeah, where is the kingdom going to be? On the earth, right. Eliminated from the earth. There you go. They're in the trash bin under the earth. Yes or no? Okay, so disempowerment first, destruction second, and third, elimination. You're out of here. Okay, good. The other flip side is salvation or deliverance, which is the same thing in the Bible, which means basically being taken out from under the threat of the bad guys and their demons and the like, and being brought into the safety of your own king, the King Jesus, or King, the God of Israel, and also then given blessings and given inheritance, permanent inheritance. See, it's the mirror image of the judgment side. Can you see that? They're eliminated, we're given permanent inheritance. And what is our ultimate permanent inheritance? Golden harps? Were you here Sunday morning? You know that, I don't believe that. What is your permanent inheritance? Come on, speak it out. The earth, the new heavens and the new earth. That's right, where we will reign with him. Are you following this idea? Now, for that reason then, any time in the Bible when you see God's judgment coming on people or God's salvation or deliverance into blessings coming on people, you've got good news. Does that happen just a couple of places or a lot? A lot. And when they come together, that's when you got like super good news, okay, when they happen in the same moment. And that's just so wonderful, I can't tell you. Because the Bible is all about blessings and curses and the covenants and that sort of thing. When God implements those two things, it's good news. Now, it's not good news for the guys who are judged, but it's good news for the guys who are redeemed that the guys who are judged are judged. It makes us sad right now, but we know ultimately, unless they are eliminated, the new world can't come. And so there's a sort of backhanded good news there for the people of God. I know it feels strange, but you probably would have danced in the streets when Hitler was destroyed too. Okay? Yes, sir.
Is there inheritance not also heaven? Think about one
people. It's kept for us in heaven.
Yeah.
That's what Peter says, isn't it? It's New Testament, I don't know. But that's what he says, yes? I do care. Yeah, I think the language is the New Testament language is that our inheritance is in heaven, it's kept in heaven, reserved for us in heaven. I think that's the kind of language that it gives. Just where Jesus is right now, what's Jesus doing right? Probably doing right now. It's been 2,000 years. I don't think anybody expected to be that long to do this. But something's been under construction up there. If you go up, if you were in heaven right now, you would probably see you'd see big fences, and you would see angels with hard hats on. Why? What are they doing? They're building something. What are they building? New Jerusalem. Because when New Jerusalem comes, when Jesus returns, that inheritance that's been kept up there for you, it comes down here. Now, I suppose in the new world, they're going to be, I'm joking when I say this, escalators and elevators, you know, that you might get invited to the heavenly court, you might be group tours, that kind of thing. But you're still an earthly creature. You were made from the earth and you were for the earth. We're on the floor of God's palace. Up there is the upper chamber. We're on the floor. And our job from the beginning was to extend, to wipe clean, to sanctify and develop the entire floor of this great cosmic temple of God's. Isn't that lovely? And so it's a big place, and we're going to have lots of things to do here. And yeah, I suppose we'll travel to other planets and things. It'll be, I don't know. But does that help a little bit? Good, thank you. It's like you have a bank account up there, but the ATM's down here. Okay, so good news when people are destroyed, good news when people are redeemed. It's wonderful, which means then that whenever you see those kinds of things happening in the Bible, rather than ignoring them and saying, that's not really relevant for you because you're under grace, you're not under the law, you're saved by faith, don't worry about all these other things. Instead, people need to be encouraged to celebrate even those what appear to us from our modern point of view, ugly sorts of things. Now, this is something I said in the small group yesterday, and I want to say it to you now because I did not say it in the hour, and I think it is an important piece here. We live in a day when people don't like the idea of war. Now, that may sound strange because in the past they liked war a whole lot more than we do now. Okay, because war was just kind of this way you made money, it's the way you had jobs and prosperity, and you know, you have an economic problem, then what you do is go whoop up on the guy next door, the next country, and then you get all his stuff, and you're better off for a while till somebody whoops up on you, but then you get your revenge later on. So it's kind of this wonderful economic reset button called warfare. Bom, bom. You know, anytime inflation got too bad, hit the reset button. Let's have a war. Anytime you have a depressed economy, hit the reset button. Got a war. And the victors get to decide the currency values and all those kinds of things. You get slaves to work in your cornfields. We had German slaves, POWs, in America. You had them too, didn't you? Working in the fields and things like that. And in fact, my postman was a World War II German prisoner. Isn't that amazing? It blew my mind when I introduced my father to him, who was a World War II vet. It was a real experience to watch those two talk to each other. Very interesting. Okay, so war has always been something that, yeah, you don't like too much, but it's also been something that's been very good for, at least for kingdoms and politicians and nations. Nowadays, we don't like it so much because we know if we have a big one, we're all going to die. Okay, there are not going to be any victors anymore. So people, especially in religion, and especially now with the rise of Islam, are deeply concerned with your religion being a violent religion also. Okay? I mean, they claim to be a religion of peace. We claim to be a religion of peace. But who is the real religion of peace? That's the $50 question, isn't it? Well, the difference between us and Islam when it comes to war, and war as a process that will yield worldwide peace one day, which is what their goal is too, is utopian, just like ours is. The difference between us and them is that we have a New Testament. If we did not have the New Testament, our religion would look a whole lot like what you would call in your country extremist Muslims. Muhammad didn't have anything over Joshua. Are you following what I'm saying? David was quite the warrior here. So this is a good thing for you, because it's not that war has ceased. It's not that the jihad of Christianity does not exist. That's not true. It does exist. It's just that when our king came here and he started the process of that great final battle for the world, he chose a strategy that no one really expected. And the strategy was, first order, we're going to take care of this evil spirits. While we do that, we're going to disempower those evil spirits by taking human beings from them, redeeming them. Does that make sense? Pulling them out, robbing him of his soldiers on earth. Pulling them out. That's gospel, good news, invitation, reconciliation to God. But in the end, when he comes back, it's going to be worse than any jihadist could ever imagine. And if you're embarrassed at Joshua, then you need to be embarrassed at what Jesus threatens he's going to do when he comes back. Okay? The grandmothers are going to die then too. The women and children are not going to be protected. Non-combatants, there are no such thing when it comes to that war, when he comes back. So don't be afraid of it, but at the same time, you do have this sort of, if you get into a debate, like I've been in some public debates with Muslims, you know, you've heard the joke about the rabbi, the imam, and the Presbyterian preacher. I've been a part of that joke, okay? as several universities in the country, and that does come up. But the wonderful thing you can say is that Jesus is fighting war for you. He's giving you opportunity to come to God in faith and reconciliation and peace so that you will be the victor one day. We don't go around killing people anymore in Jesus' name. We go around trying to defraud Satan of his people by winning them to Christ. That's our battle. And we fight against those demons and devils like crazy. You like that? Say yes, please. Yes, good. I hope you do, because it's a lovely, lovely thing. Be grateful we have a New Testament. Okay, now we come to the second major topic of the week. Good thing to do that on the last day, I guess. And that is preaching Christ in the Old Testament, preaching Christ in or from the Old Testament. And that's our main topic, and we're going to do four different things, some popular outlooks. Then we're going to talk about a topic that will set the pace for the way I think you should preach Christ in the Old Testament. It's broadly speaking usually called typology. We're going to talk about the offices of Christ and how that helps us do this, gives us a system for doing it, and then how it can yield ways to preach about Jesus from Old Testament passages. So let's look at some popular outlooks. Here's the deal. You got Old Testament texts. We got a lot of those things. And when you take a look at the way New Testament authors treat the Old Testament, and you compare the two, it causes some problems. Now, most people don't know enough about the Old Testament ever to be concerned with this. Okay, they assume that the New Testament writers are simply saying what the Old Testament said, and that the connections when they quote the Old Testament are obvious. But if you studied the Old Testament at all, you know sometimes the New Testament quotes the Old, and it's not obvious what they're saying about it. Can I put it that way? In fact, people, many times, even evangelicals would say, they're reading their own Christian faith into the Old Testament. Say, I know that. Okay, thank you very much. I hope you do. I think I have some passages. I think that's what's coming next. They find Christ in the Old Testament sometimes in what we might consider some of the strangest ways imaginable. Now, you don't sense that if you don't know the Old Testament. You just assume that the Old Testament says what they said it was going to say. But otherwise, you may have some problems. The question will be this. We usually speak of an evangelical approach to exegesis or interpretation as grammatico-historical, which means we want to study the grammar of the text, the words of the text, that kind of thing, and then study the content of the text in the context of its historical setting, and that is normative. It determines the meaning, at least the initial trajectory of meaning for us, and then that we align ourselves with that. That's what we basically view as evangelical, conservative, traditional, reformational, any other words I need to put on that, in hermeneutics, okay? And that's fine and good, but the question is that what New Testament writers do? When you look at passages like Matthew 2, verses 14 through 15, so he got up, that's Joseph, took the child Jesus and his mother Mary during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. So was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet Hosea, in chapter 11, verse 1, out of Egypt I called my son. Now, I have even heard Christian apologists use this as an apologetic for Jesus, that it was predicted about 500 years before Jesus' birth, 700 years before Jesus' birth, that, or 800 actually, before Jesus' birth anyway, that he was going to go to Egypt and come out. And you can understand why people would say that about this verse, because that's what Matthew seems to be saying is happening. There's a prediction in Hosea 11:1, that's the passage he's quoting, that predicts that Jesus will go to Egypt and then God will call him out of Egypt. Doesn't it look like that to you? Doesn't it? Okay. And that's all fine and good unless you've read the book of Hosea. Has anyone in here read the book of Hosea ever in your whole life? Okay. If you've ever read it your whole life, and especially if you've tried to teach through it, then you know that in Hosea 11:1, it's not even making a prediction. It's a historical fact that he's declaring. Something in the past, out of Egypt, I called my son. And all you have to do is read a couple of verses and you know who the son is also. What son is this? Who is it? Israel. And when did God do that? Under Moses. This is not even a prediction about anything. It's a statement of fact that Hosea then builds on to establish the moral obligations of Israel. Imagine such a thing as that, moral obligation. So once you get to know Hosea a little bit, tension starts rising inside of you. Do you understand what I'm saying? Whether you realize this or not, can you understand the basic problem? Yeah? Okay, good. Another example, just for fun, a couple more. 1 Corinthians 10:4. This is where he describes the Israelites going through the wilderness, and he says, "For they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ." Wow. What does that mean? I mean, is there anything when you look at Exodus about this rock and the water coming from it that would make you think it's, I don't know, make like a cross on the back of it or something? It sort of makes you think of Narnia, doesn't it? Is that okay? You know, the talking trees and things like that. And okay, so it means like, what, are we going to see a face in the rock? Or like the burnt cheese sandwich that has a face of Jesus on it? Have you seen that on the internet? By the way, Christians are not the only ones that do that. Muslims do that also. They find the name Allah written in Arabic all over the place. Go on the website, you'll see it. You just look it up. Just say, "Name of Yahweh in nature," or Allah in nature. And they'll show you all over the place. I mean, it's like in apples, and it's like in onions, and it's like in the clouds, and on people's faces and stuff. Which is their doctrine of general revelation, I suppose. Okay, so we know that something strange is going on here. How did Paul know that this rock was Christ, and what in the world did he even mean by that? You follow what I'm saying? Okay, so immediately you're wondering, is this grammatico-historical exegesis that Paul's performing when he finds Jesus in that passage? Another one, Ephesians chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, which is a quotation from Psalm 68, which is about God's victory over his enemies. And he says here, when he, that's Jesus, ascended on high, and is a reference to his ascension into heaven, he took many captives and gave gifts to his people. And the Hebrew actually says he received gifts from his people, or received gifts from people. So now we really wonder what's going on, don't we? Are the apostles and prophets of the New Testament following the kind of exegesis that you learn at Cornhill, or are they not? And if they're not, what do you do about it? Do you follow the issue here? Have you had this crisis of faith yet? Have you? You're not responding, have you? I guess not, huh? Well, you need to read the Bible. You'll have it. Okay. That'll be a great thing. All right, there are two main options going on these days as you hear explanations of this phenomenon in the Bible. One of them we might call an older tendency, and the older evangelical tendency was to say this: yes, these are esoteric readings of the Bible. In other words, you can't see it for yourself. Okay, a sort of secret knowledge that apostles and prophets were given. But it's authorized by God, so therefore, just shut up. It's a case of special pleading, as it were. This is an apostle, so he can say that this passage means something that you could not get out of it by the ordinary means of exegesis. Have you heard that before? Good, good. It's a nice ace up your sleeve, to use that expression. Yeah, you know, when you have an ace up your sleeve, anytime you need an ace, you just pull it out. You got it, and you win. And, you know, A for apostles, lay it down on the table. So you win the game. All right. I hope that feels unsatisfying to you. I think it's terribly unsatisfying to me, because I don't think that apostles were ever given the right, and certainly not authorized by Holy Spirit, to make the Bible say something it wasn't saying. And if they did, then I would wonder what else we're missing. Okay, so that's the older tendency. The newer tendency that's come out in recent decades, as there's more and more literature coming from the intertestamental period, especially the so-called Second Temple period, which is near the time of Jesus, the documents that we have there do weird things with the Bible. Oh, they do really weird things with the Bible. If you were to read some of these Qumran texts, Dead Sea Scroll texts and things like that, like 11Q Melchizedek, for example, if you were to read about what they believed about Melchizedek at Qumran, The 11th cave at Qumran is a whole, it's devoted to Melchizedek. How about that? It's only a fragment, but you can Google it. You can find a picture of it. It's wonderful. Take a look. Just Google 11 cube Melchizedek, okay? And you can see it. It's unbelievable. You can find that. And I first discovered that in Starbucks. This is stuff, that's the kind of stuff you used to kill for 20 years ago. I mean, you would pay money for, travel long distances, and then have to murder somebody to take a look at it. But now it's on Google, okay? So what can you say? But at any rate, for them, Melchizedek is an eschatological end-time figure who's an angel. He's a superhuman being who actually comes to the earth, and he offers the last great atonement to end all atonements in the latter days. When the year of Jubilees is finally observed, and he offers the very last atonement in the temple in Jerusalem, and then the end comes. Melchizedek does this. Now, he's not some Jesus. He's Melchizedek, the old guy that died, who's come back as an angel. You follow what I'm saying? And now, just knowing that lets you understand a little more what the book of Hebrews is talking about. Christians were the only ones thinking there was going to come a day when the sacrifices would end. Imagine that. Okay, so you can understand then that the book of Hebrews is now arguing against this false teaching that it is Melchizedek who's doing this. Rather, the book of Hebrews argues that it is a king according from the line of David according to the order of Melchizedek who's going to do that, and that is none other than Messiah. That is none other than Jesus. Do you follow the argument, basically? Okay. Well, they do bizarre things with the Bible in these intertestamental sects of Israel, because there were many different denominations in Israel when Jesus walked on this earth and when the apostles lived, and they had all kinds of weird, bizarre ideas. Much like if you were to watch Christian TV and you were to see all the weird interpretations they have of the Bible on Christian TV, that's what you get when you look at the variety of interpretations among the Jews in the first century. Weird, bizarre stuff. Okay. These are the ways that people try to explain this. And what they say is, the newer version is, that basically what you've got in the New Testament is sectarian reading of the Old Testament. That Christians had Jesus on the brain. And they were so dominated by their faith and their loyalty to Jesus, they found him everywhere. Just like all Jews found whatever they wanted to find anywhere in the Bible. Okay, that's the way it goes. That should be unsatisfying to you also. Because while it's true that Christianity was just one among many groups of Jews, it's not sectarian, it's the truth. And these sects of Israel twisted the Bible to support their ideologies. And we should not believe that New Testament apostles and prophets twisted the Bible to make it suit their ideology, but rather that it genuinely grows out of the Bible. Okay. There are the popular tendencies. Do you have any questions about those two? There are people who use the name evangelical, yes. You understand this one, but not that one? Yeah. Well, let me just say, some of the people in the yellow over there, they are beginning to lose their jobs in evangelical schools. Okay? But once they come out of the closet, they're out of the closet. It's hard to go back in. But yeah, it's beginning to be, well, unfortunately in your country, you know, you have soft evangelicals, hard evangelicals, and everywhere in between. You got to, you know, so people who use the name evangelical are saying this, yes. Yes?
And so G.K. Beale and D.A. Carson, which would they call it?
Neither.
Neither.
Thank you very much. You think I'm going to come to this place and disagree with Greg Beale or D.A. Carson? Are you insane? Look, I'll tell you what the dean of our seminary said to a student. He said, you know, you're right. Richard might be a heretic, but let me just tell you something. You'll never know it. He's been doing this a long time. He's not about to make a mistake like that. I mean, I'm no fool. I know not to disagree with D.A. Carson and Greg Beale here. Amen, Willie? Yeah. No, they're not the bad boys. They're the good boys, because what they're arguing for is a continuity between the original meaning of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Okay, which is, of course, what I'm going to argue for. Yes, you know that already, right? Okay, but it's a hard trek to follow. It's a long road to hoe. It's a path with many twists and turns, and is more complicated than simply saying, well, they're apostles, they can do what they want to do, or they're sectarians, they can do what they want to do. Okay. So, what will Richard say? Richard will say that along with people like D.A. Carson and Greg Beale, I suppose, although I didn't get this from them, okay, but we are in the same basic hermeneutical track, that one of the best, easiest ways in the time that we have allotted to it, there are other ways to go at this, but one of the easiest ways to do this is to work on the Bible idea of typology. I know that's a terminology you've heard before. Say yes, please. Okay. And so we just need to unpack that a little bit, and I'll try to give you my spin on it, which I don't think is really a very hard spin. I think it's just basically clarifying a few things and sort of orienting us toward what the church has always meant by typology. I don't think I'm trying to do anything new here, but I do think it may help us to take some steps that will actually be useful in preaching, okay? So let's just start off with what the term typology actually means. Ology on the end obviously means the study or the doctrine of something, but the word type comes from some New Testament passages. One of those would be Romans 5:14. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as Adam did, who was a pattern, that's the word tupos in Greek, who was a pattern of the one to come. Here the apostle saying that Adam was a type of, translated here, pattern of, the one to come who was none other than Jesus. Do you follow that? Okay, so that's where the vocabulary of typology comes from. Yes or no? Okay, good. There's a counter to a type, and that is an anti-type, we say in English. It doesn't mean it's against the type, it just means it's the other side, the reverse, the mirror image, the other side of the comparison is going on here. And you can find that word in 1 Peter 3:20. In the days of Noah, 8 persons were brought safely through the water, and corresponding to that, that's the way the New American Standard translates it, corresponding to that, that's antipatos, okay? And so corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. So you can understand the type is Noah in the ark with his family, the anti-type, or the fulfillment, we would probably more be inclined to say, the correspondent to that is baptism saving you now. Yes or no? They were saved by the water, you're saved by baptism, all that kind of stuff. So that's where the vocabulary comes from. There's another alternative to that vocabulary set, and that's the vocabulary of shadow and substance, or shadow and reality. For example, Colossians 2:17, these are a shadow of the things that were to come. The reality, however, is found in Christ. The terminology that Paul uses there is really interesting. Skia for a shadow, that's normal. But soma, does anybody know what soma normally means? What's somatic? What's a somatic problem? Well, psychosomatic. The body, right. The brain and the body, okay? So soma is the normal word for this thing here. But the metaphor he's using here is that a physical body like yours, or the body of a tree or a body of a plant, can cast a shadow when the sun's over here. It casts a shadow. You follow me? And notice in most of these cases, that the language of the one to come, something to come, is very interesting, because unfortunately, Christians often think, and be careful of this, please, they often think of typology along the lines of Plato, as opposed to the Bible. For Plato, the analogy is between the lower world and the upper world, the world of the empirical, physical things, and the world of ideals up here. Okay, and so we often think that that's what the Bible means when it says earth and heaven, that correlation there. But in the Bible, the typologies are much more diachronic, they're much more chronological. Something happens here that is an anticipation of, a shadow of, a foreshadowing of something that's coming later, the one to come, the things to come. And we'll talk about why that might be the case in just a moment. So that's where the language of typology comes from. Now let's give a definition if we can, best I can do anyway. Biblical typology is basically this. It's the study of diachronic developments. What's diachronic developments mean?
Through time.
over time, developments over time, of theological structures, theological concepts, arrangements of concepts. So it's the study of how theological concepts develop over time, okay, that are closely associated with certain persons, certain institutions, and certain events. Those last three lines, or the last three segments there, are fairly important here. That typologies, when you look at them in the Bible, when they take something earlier and they say, this is over here too, or this is an anticipation of that, or it's a shadow of that, it's a type of that, they sometimes talk about people. This person, that person. Sometimes they talk about institutions. And by institution, I don't know a better word than that. It's just something that's erected, a sustained reality, like the services at the tabernacle, for example. That would be institutional. And like your church services or your local church is an institution. Do you follow what I mean then? So it's not we use the expression we don't so much, one-off. It's not a one-off. It's something that's fairly stable and consistent in its activities and its performances and its purposes. Okay, so people, institutions, and then other things that you have to sort of do a catch-all of associated events. They may be one-offs. Yes or no? Okay, so what happens then is you have people, institutions, events back here in the Old Testament that have a value, a significance that is repeated and echoed through diachrony, through time, up until, of course, as Christians, Jesus. And this is the model that I want you to start thinking about when you think about what it means to preach Christ from the Old Testament. That you're up here, you know about Jesus, and what you're doing is a retrospective trace, a retrospective diachronic trace. How about that? What's that mean? You're doing it through time, but you're doing it retrospectively. What's that mean? Retrospect. Looking backwards. So you're up here. You know the end of the game. And so what you're doing is you're looking through time back to the earlier things. Does that make sense? Okay, good. All right, great. Okay, so given that then, if you can follow that so much, there's the definition then. So here's what we're basically saying. We're saying that there are people in the Old Testament, there are institutions in the Old Testament, and there are events in the Old Testament that have correlations with people, institutions, and events that happen later on in history. Many of them go over and over and over. You can build them up one after another, after another, after another. And of course, as Christians, we believe, and I've been pushing this very hard, that at the end of this track is New Testament theology. Now, how is it that people, institutions, and events have significance? How is it that an individual person, an individual event, an individual institution, how do they have significance? Where do they get their significance from? The answer to that should be seen right here in this old chart that you've seen before. Items like those fit into a grid of sorts, a theological structure. And that's where they find their significance. Yes or no? I mean, lots of people made boats. Noah's boat was different. And the reason we know it's different is because the Bible gives us a theology surrounding it. Did you see the movie? Okay. Well, not very many people had those rock men building the ark for them, okay? Okay, so there's the Old Testament theological system. By the way, that comes from the Talmud. But anyway, of course, here's the New Testament. That's what we believe in. Those are the theological structures of the New Testament. And then we know that because the Bible is given to us bit by bit over a long period of time, there are organic developments between the Old and the New Testament, like a tree that grows. So if you think of the Old Testament back here at the beginning like a seed, is the seed different from or is the seed the same as the full-grown tree at the end of the trip? I'll say it again. Is the seed at the beginning the same as or different from the tree at the end, full-grown tree? The answer is yes. What did that mean? Well, use the analogy again of a seed or an acorn and a full-grown tree. Okay, just use that as an analogy. Superficially, at first glance, the seed that you took a picture of before you planted it, and you then look at the apple tree that grew from it 10 years later, they don't look very much like each other, do they? Are you awake out there? Okay. You can nod. You at least do that much, okay? No, they don't. Okay, good. But the reality is that if you were to do a genetic analysis of that seed, say you take a sample from it and you do a full karyotyping of it and that sort of thing, and you know all the structures and so on, and then you were to go to the forest or the orchard with lots of apple trees, you took samples of all those apple trees, you could figure out which one with some high percentage, like an O.J. Simpson percentage, 98.88888%, that this is the tree that came from this seed. Do you follow me? But you have to look beneath the surface. When the Apostle Peter compares or says that the baptism is the antitype of the flood of Noah, are those like each other or different from each other? Yes. You follow me? Okay. And the differences are very obvious just with a quick glance at them. So what is Peter doing? Is he so silly and trivial that he actually thinks that any fool walking down the street can see this? If you had a movie of Noah's flood and you had a movie of somebody being baptized, they'd look just like the same. You could overlay them. There they would be. Is that what he's saying? Of course not. He knows they're different, but he knows something else too, and that is that the theological significance of them, the theological structures, the DNA, as it were, in the two are the same. Similar enough that they can be compared. How does he compare them? Because what we have in a type and an antitype is like a metaphor. And a metaphor consists of the topic, that's the real thing, the image, the thing it's being compared to, and the ways they're compared to each other. Three pieces of every metaphorical or analogous operation. You have the thing itself, that's Noah. You have the thing it's being compared to, that would be baptism. And then there are some ways in which they are like each other, and then there are some ways they're not like each other. You with me? That's always the case. Okay. So, in what ways does Peter say explicitly that baptism and Noah's flood are like each other? He mentions it. They both involve water. Good. They both involve salvation. Salvation. Good. Okay. But he knows that they're different also, aren't they? How are those two events different from each other? Pardon me? Size and scale, I would think, might be a difference. Can you give me another? Noah had a boat. Did you have a boat when you were baptized? I think not. Okay, do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so there are just as many, and usually even more, dissimilarities than there are similarities. So when you make these kinds of comparisons, you're looking for what the significant things are that connect them to each other. And that is provided to you by the theological structures that are given at the event itself and then with the fulfillment of it in its antitype up here. Yes or no? I'm walking slowly through this, but I feel like I'm boring you to death. Am I boring you to death, or are you having to ponder this a bit? Are you pensive or bored? Pensive. Okay, good. Let's stop then. Ask me a question. Yeah. How the flood of Noah is like baptism? Is that what you're saying? Don't ask me. That's a New Testament question. I mean, in general terms, what he says is fairly straight up, and that is that water was used for the salvation of Noah, and water is used for your salvation too. Now, he then clarifies something, doesn't he? He says, not the washing off of the body, not that, but what? That's right. It's an appeal to God from a good conscience. Good conscience. Thank you very much. In other words, it's an inner washing that correlates the two. And so even he has to go, I mean, because it's so obvious there's a difference here. He has to go, well, now, not in that way, but in this way. Okay? The universe was saved through the flood. And you are saved through the baptism too. Yes?
What point, or is there a point where you need to distinguish between what looking back is just a kind of a neat illustration of something in the New Testament, as opposed to divinely kind of foretold and organic. So I think about allegorization, you know, getting to allegory, where you could like say, well, that's a kind of illustration of something we're talking about now, as opposed to that thing that was
great. Great. You use the operative word here. The important word was predictive. Okay? And you only have a prediction if something's a prediction. You don't have a mere analogy or a mere illustration when something, in fact, in redemptive history or in the history of biblical faith has significant theological analogies to something that happens later. It's not a mere illustration anymore. See, that's the kind of binary distinction I'm trying to get you away from. Precisely that. I'm trying to say to you, look, Noah's flood is not something that's isolated, that Peter's simply saying by authority as an apostle, it's a type, but nobody else could get it. If you understand what the flood was in the days of the flood, you will understand why it is that Peter can make this connection and why it is that the flood of Noah literally, really anticipates the glorious change of the world in the end.
Is that true of Matthew?
Yeah, we will as we get to it. Yeah, we'll have to have a chance to get to it. He's asking, is that true of, from Israel did I call my son? From Egypt did I call my son? The answer is yes, because as early as Deuteronomy, God calls Israel his son, Deuteronomy chapter 8. The whole nation is his son. But once you have a king, guess who the great suzerain, the great king, calls his son? Guess who? In the ancient Near East. Who do you think the great king calls his son?
The nation.
The nation, but more than that. There's a particular person who gets called that. Can you guess who? We've got the letters. The king. The vassal king. He'll call the nation his children, no problem. But when he writes the letters, we got the letters on this, okay? The vassal king will appeal to the suzerain king. These are just great kings and lesser kings. And they will say, Father. And when the answer comes from the great king to the lesser king, guess what they call them? My son. Okay? The whole nation, it's my family, it's my children. But this is my son, because he represents all of them to me. Say, yes, I got it. Okay, so once you are post-monarchy, once you have a monarch, which is where Jesus is, of course, and where Matthew is, they know that what was being said of the nation as a whole is now fulfilled in the king, in the royal family. So you don't have to go through all this rigmarole of Jesus is Israel and all this kind of stuff. You don't have to do that. All you got to do is say, Jesus is the King of Israel. You know what I'm talking about? He's corporate Israel piled into one like a big old exploding bomb, things like that. You know, all the analogies that people use. The reason Jesus can stand for Israel, the reason the things that are said like servant, my servant of the nation, can be said of him is because he's the King. When Barack Obama speaks, America speaks. It's that simple. If you don't believe it, then look at Ukraine. Look at Syria. Did you see a bunch of Americans running over to Syria to fight against the terrorists? No, they joined the terrorists now. But do you see them fighting against them even though Barack Obama said don't? Do you see that? No. The nation does what the representative says. You with me on this? Okay. The champion, the king. And that's the way it is with this. So it's really very nice. You just have to get into these boxes. And see, this is not, these boxes down here are not your Christian religion. Saved by grace through faith, and that not of yourself. Okay, pray a lot, things like that. Okay, that's your stuff up there. This is the real stuff here. This is the background to all that stuff. But if you get these boxes, you've got the concepts, you've got the conceptual grid that allows you then to start seeing these connections that New Testament writers actually make. We'll stop at this, but let me just tell you this real fast, because this is going to blow your mind. here's what's so wonderful. When you take a look at the Bible, and remember I said you've got people, institutions, and events. Remember all that? Okay? And that these are connected to each other in various spheres of life. You can understand that. But if you have a temple, if you're talking about the worship of Israel, you're talking about the priests, you're talking about the temple services, you're talking about times when they sang songs. That would be an event. You with me on this? Yes or no? Okay, great. And though you have things on the antitype also, the physical thing, that also has people, institutions, and events. It's really very nice when you can see this for a moment. Take, for example, what happens with Peter comparing baptism to the flood. Where is the flood of Noah in that scheme there? People, institutions, events. It's an event. It was not an institutionalized event, right? So you can have Noah's flood every week. Every Sunday, we're going to Noah's flood. No, it was an event. Okay? But when Peter says that the antitype to that is baptism, what is that? It's an institution. Imagine this. This is what's so wonderful about this, is it now begins to give you a way of understanding the variety of typologies that are in the New Testament. That's what's so good about this. Because people in the Old Testament are correlated in the New Testament with people, with institutions, and with events. So you don't have to look for people to people all the time. You can look for people to institutions. You can look from people to events. Okay, that's one way. Let's look at another. Go institution to institution? Well, sure you can do that. The temple, the church. Of course you can do that. That's the easy stuff, right? But the wonderful thing is that institutions are antityped, as it were, by all three also. Isn't this wonderful? Now, all of a sudden, rather than just being the temple in Israel and the church, institution to institution, it's now the temple in Israel and, give me the person, Jesus. You see what I'm saying? Why is that? Because over here, you're in the sphere of worship, devotion, praise, and sacrifice, and that involves people, institutions, and events. And over here, you're involved in the same kind of reference point in the life of the people of God today. And so, you can say the temple, and you can say in the next breath, the high priest. And the wonder of it all is that in the end, I guess we're moving toward events now, when the whole world becomes the temple of God, is not calling New Testament authors liars when they say Jesus is the temple. Or when they say your body is the temple. Or when they say your local church is the temple. Because the reality is that the institution of the temple in the Old Testament correlates to all of those. Like when two or three are gathered in my name. Where's the language of name come from, you PTC people? We did it in Chronicles last week. Where's God's name? In the temple. So when Jesus says two or three are gathered in my name, Israel knows what that means. There I will be with them. Isn't that grand? But what you have to realize is that all of these beliefs and ideas form webs of multiple reciprocities. If you don't know what that means, ask Rupert. He's memorized it. Okay? And what we're talking about is just several of the ways you can trace them. It's just magnificent. It's so freeing. You're going to have so much to preach, you won't know what to do. Events. Events in the Old Testament are also correlated to people, and correlated to institutions, and correlated to other events. So there you go. So when you start asking the question, what's going on here? What is this New Testament writer comparing this to that? What is the this? What is the that? What are the things then that are associated with this and that they're comparing? And you start thinking, rather than thinking of a thin thread, what you're thinking is a bunch of threads like this, like a cord, a rope that's wrapped around, okay, webs of multiple reciprocity, like this, then you know you've got complex of ideas, sets of ideas, not just single ideas that are connected at pinpoint. Say, I got it. See, this is then where the freedom of preaching comes. Because in preaching, what you get to do is pick which thread you want to talk about that Sunday. You can't talk about the whole rope. I'm sorry, just too many threads. But you can pick which thread you're going to talk about that Sunday. It's so magnificent, I can't tell you. Because you don't have to get the right answer, okay, and say it exactly like you need to say it, so that if anybody quotes you, you're not going to get in trouble. All you have to do is say the truth. Do you hear that? Tell the truth. And then when they say, why didn't you say this also? Then you say this to them. What do you say to them? You can't say everything. Rupert, do you know this one also? You don't, do you? You can't, when we ordained you last night, you can't say everything when you say anything. If you try, you'll never say anything because you'll always be saying everything else. Right? No sermon can say it all. Even when God speaks to human beings, he can't say everything. You can't do it in your sermons either. So what you have to say is the truth. And then when they question, just say, well, yeah, that's true, but you can't say everything when you say anything. Then they'll let you go because they don't understand it. Okay, the wonder of all this for me personally is that it begins then to both help us, and for those of you who are young at preaching, new at preaching, it can also be debilitating. But I find that to be wonderful, and I'll tell you why, and with this I'll close. I have a friend who is a drill instructor in the United States Marines. That means he's the sergeant, the non-commissioned officer that would get in the cadets' faces and make them feel like animals and turn them into animals so they could become real fighters and that kind of thing, screaming at them all the time at the basic training. And I asked him one time, I said, what's the most important thing that you do in basic training? He thought for a minute. He said, I know what it is. I said, what is it? He says, when they go to the firing range where you shoot the rifles the first time, when they go there, I want them to be afraid to pull the trigger. I said, what? That's weird. Why do you want them to be afraid to pull the trigger? And then he laughed and he said, because most Marines have already killed 1,000 deer and 5 people before they become Marines. Okay, they're already murderers, and they think they know all about guns. And if they think they know anything about guns, when they walk up to that firing line, they're going to kill somebody. He wants them afraid to pull the trigger, so they'll learn anew how to pull the trigger. Does that make sense? They'll back off. They'll be cautious about it. They'll be small-minded about it, rather than, oh, yeah, I know. Well, that is the job of Cornhill and of Richard Pratt this week. Okay, is to make you go, all right, I'm going to the firing line. Maybe I don't know as much about this as I thought I did. Maybe it's a little more complicated than I thought it was. That way you'll back off, keep the safety on the gun, and wait till you get there, and then you'll turn the safety off rather than just walking around with it like this. You ever been with somebody with a gun doing this? What do you do? Oh, it's not loaded. Right? Boom! That's what people do when they think that they know what they're doing with it. So I'm just trying to say to you, on the one side, yes, this should sort of confuse you at this moment. It should make you cautious. That's great. But as we come back this afternoon, it's also going to be enlivening. It's going to say, man, I've got so many opportunities now to preach the truth that I never even knew I had before. And it'll be fantastic. Thank you very much. Go eat lunch.